ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Jack McLennan was 27, fit and visibly strong.
He was trained well. He knew how to hit, and I was gobsmacked.
He seemed ready for anything, but then he suddenly vanished.
I was just talking to him last night. Like, how the hell does that happen?
I'm Rob Bergen. Join me as I investigate what became of Jack in the new season of Unravel.
There has to be something more nefarious going on.
Search for the Unravel podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Big Ideas on ABC Radio National and its podcast. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Coming up, ending wars needs people to lay down their guns. But does it also need gender equality? And when you see all the men in suits at international security roundtables, do you find yourself asking, what would happen to the world if more women were in the room? Pleased to bring you the annual Pamela Dinoon Lecture today, a dialogue between three women at the Australian National University on feminist answers in a dangerous world. And the series is named after the founder of the National Foundation for Australian Women. Now let's start with former Australian Ambassador to NATO, the European Union, Belgium, Luxembourg, Caroline Miller. She's seen up close how geopolitical power works and served as Deputy Secretary for National Security in the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. So how does she read the current geopolitical tumult and where we're heading? She's starting with Australia's track record of engaging with women leaders globally. The recent visit by the President of the European Commission was a good reminder.
We had a very big event in Australia, the visit by the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. I'll start with this rather staggering fact. President von der Leyen was the first woman leader to address a joint session of the Australian Parliament. And that caused a real ripple around the room when that was said, and spontaneous applause in the chamber. And a female departmental head and I were sitting next to each other and we exchanged glances, which were really glances of how could this possibly have taken so long? And President von der Leyen made a very charming comment about how she hoped the next woman leader to address the parliament would happen much more quickly than her address. When I look at those big, really important senior jobs, it disappoints me after all this time that there are so few people in those jobs and to have something like one woman Prime Minister of Australia, the first woman leader only now in 2026 to address the Australian parliament. But look, I'll just give a bit of a geopolitical overview and happy to also talk about NATO perhaps in the discussion. Everyone here in this room will know we're living in a time of heightened geostrategic competition and increased great power rivalry. And at a time when great powers are feeling increasingly unbound by what has been known as the international rules-based order, by international law. And I'm not just talking about our adversaries. Indeed, the theme of this year's Munich Security Conference was under destruction, as in the international order is under destruction, which is a very depressing theme. It'll also be obvious to all of you that we're living through tectonic geoeconomic shifts, exacerbated by unprecedented accelerating technological change we can barely process. Well, speaking personally, I can barely process it. Right now, not only Australia, but also our partners in Asia and Europe are wondering what's next, how do we navigate it? Some of you will have heard Prime Minister Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister's skillfully crafted speech at Davos this year, which delivered a punchy analysis of the so-called rules-based international order previously underwritten by the United States. As he noted, we knew it was imperfect. But overall, it provided predictability, massive global growth, and an efficient globalised trading system largely beneficial to the economies of countries like Australia. I mean, the benefits were uneven, but largely beneficial to a country like us. And the international architecture established after World War II enabled a world free from the major conflicts that had so tragically torn the world apart in the first half of the 20th century. That was then. Today, we're in a world where coercion by the big powers to get what they want, including subservience to their interests, is becoming the norm. In contravention not only of global rules, but for example in the economic space, freely negotiated bilateral trade agreements, as Australia found with China in 2019, when we had the temerity to call for a WHO investigation into the origins of COVID-19. We had a free trade agreement and a comprehensive economic or strategic partnership with China, but that didn't stop it from imposing massive sanctions. In Europe, Russia's unjustified, immoral and illegal war in Ukraine grinds on. A gruesome mix of First World War high casualty combat and 21st century technological and hybrid warfare. When Russia invaded Ukraine in 2022, Australia would have understood if Europe and NATO had shifted back from what was then a relatively recent focus on the Indo-Pacific, back to Europe and the Transatlantic Alliance. But we were relieved and pleased that, though uneven, European focus on the opportunities afforded by engagement with the economically dynamic Indo-Pacific region and a keen appreciation of the tensions which could impact not only regional countries but also the Euro-Atlantic, remained. Assisted by the China-Russia-Xi-Putin No Limits Partnership and the parallels between Russian and Chinese economically coercive behaviour. But the behaviour of the United States since the 20th of January last year has changed things. The US is Australia's closest ally, indispensable security partner and a major trading partner. And the same is true for all 31 NATO allies, mainly Europeans, and in our region for Japan, Korea and others. Now, everyone expected disruption. The President had made no secret of his desire to use tariffs in the way he has. And I should add that while Australia has come off relatively lightly, and I'm looking at seeing a free trade negotiator over there, the tariffs imposed are still inconsistent with our 2005 gold standard free trade agreement. US allies were also anticipating a renewed US push for them to step up on defence, not unreasonably, and many have indeed stepped up in their own interests. But the President has gone further than any of us could have imagined. His determination to acquire Greenland, a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, a NATO ally of the United States, has been a wake-up call for Europe and for all of us, even if the immediate crisis has been averted. From a visit I made with a National Security College delegation a few weeks ago, my sense is that President Trump has done what Putin alone could not, shift Europe's and NATO's focus back to the Euro-Atlantic, to what many European colleagues describe to us as a toxic transatlantic relationship, and that is not a good thing. While most we spoke to felt deterrence against Russia was holding for now, they worry about the trajectory of the Ukraine war and Russian threats to Europe should US commitment to NATO weaken. And they must be feeling this more keenly now with the Iran war as that plays out. The earlier US and Israeli surgical strikes in Iran were targeted and had a logic to destroy Iran's capacity to develop nuclear weapons. But the rationale for this current war of choice is hard to understand. The economic ramifications are potentially devastating, destabilizing oil supplies and hiking global energy prices, and none of us know how or when it will end or what the longer-term ramifications for Iran, the Middle East or globally will be. And extraordinarily, a key beneficiary at present appears to be Russia, as the US lifts sanctions on Russian and Iranian oil to stabilize global energy prices. These funds can only assist the Russian war effort in Ukraine. Now, despite such pressing preoccupations, none of us can afford to take our eye off the pacing challenge of China. And while we've seen a steady stream of European leaders head to China in recent weeks to diversify economically away from the Americans, the world turned upside down, getting China right was one of the themes of European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen's visit to Australia, and I'll discuss that at the end. China remains the overwhelming challenge of our time. It has deliberately set out to dominate the technologies of the future and build dependencies for critical minerals in Western democracies and globally. And Chinese industrial overcapacity risks flooding others' markets, undermining their industries. China's military expansion is eye-watering. Its navy increases by the total tonnage of the Australian Navy about every 18 months. It's rapidly expanding its nuclear arsenal with no transparency whatsoever. Its increasingly coercive military behaviour is not only in the Taiwan Straits, but also in other things like Chinese naval circumnavigation of Australia early last year. So these multiple challenges, some call a polycrisis, pose fundamental questions for Western like-minded democracies like our own about how we respond. And as we all know, and I'm sure we'll discuss in during the session, at times of crisis, women and girls are often disproportionately affected. So to what extent is it possible to continue to adhere to and preserve the global rules and norms? To what extent do we seek protection for our own industries or seek to decouple or diversify away from problematic trading partners? To be clear, decoupling from China is not feasible. Our economies are simply too dependent on Chinese supply chains, and China is by far our largest trading partner. So like the Europeans, we need to de-risk through developing more autonomous capabilities and diversifying our markets and partners. And the good news is, as we found when China placed those sanctions upon us, we can do this, particularly with market diversification. As the Foreign Minister put in a major speech to the Australian Institute of International Affairs late last year, Australia's economic security must evolve in the face of states weaponising trade and undermining supply chains, and this means resilience and diversification. Now, in finishing up, I'd just like to, in these opening remarks, I'd like to talk a little bit about President von der Leyen's highly successful visit to Australia, because it illustrates many of the points I've been discussing. And first is the absolute necessity of a global view and partnerships. As the President said to a joint city of Parliament, our world today is not being defined by neighbourhood. Distance is no longer a protection or a luxury. And I think perhaps in Australia we've been guilty of thinking that it might be. If the Straits of Hormuz or the Straits of Malacca are blocked, she said, it affects all of us. So while Australia has rightly put a big emphasis on the Indo-Pacific, and I think this government has done a very good job in that respect, a worldview is also imperative. The President came to finalise three important deals, and these are very close to my heart, so you'll have to allow me to talk about them. The first was the long-awaited Australia-EU Free Trade Agreement, also a defence and security partnership, and perhaps most significantly, Australia's decision to commence negotiations on association with Horizon Europe, the world's largest pooled funding framework for international research collaboration and strongly supported by this university. Of particular interest to this audience will also be the WPS provisions of the Defence Agreement, which the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and I don't take responsibility for this, it was after I left, put a lot of work into, and some provisions in the FTA, which are deliberately designed to benefit women's business. Now, President von der Leyen was unflinching about global challenges, but she also spoke warmly and positively about the value of trusted partnerships with Australia and others. And one phrase that resonated very strongly with the audience and many picked up over the couple of days she was in Australia was trust, not transaction. The agreements reached this week will anchor a relationship between two partners with common interests and values and assist economic diversification. But their strategic importance is almost more significant in the signal they send to others. And as the Foreign Minister also said last year in her big speech, without working with partners, the world will be more deferential to authoritarians, and the norms that middle powers rely on will be replaced by a new normal. So I'd like to finish up there. I really wanted to focus on President von der Leyen's speech visit, not just because it was a very significant visit for Australia, but because of the fact of President von der Leyen as a strong woman leader and the enormous impact that she has been able to have in her role, which I think is really a great inspiration for all of us. Thank you.
One example of a woman leader fostering trust and allyship at a time when male leaders are waging wars. Former Australian Ambassador to NATO and the European Union, Caroline Miller there, reflecting on the recent visit by the President of the European Commission. Well, now on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell, why do women matter to peace and security? It's more than 25 years since the UN Security Council adopted its Women, Peace and Security Resolution, or WPS agenda, which really put women, not just men, at the heart of deliberations about security. Is it working, especially in the face of the current backlash against women's rights globally? Caroline is joined now by Dr. Elise Stevenson, who is Deputy Director of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at the Australian National University, and asking questions is former ACT Young Woman of the Year, Asha Clementi, a principal of the Persephone Network, which is a youth-led organisation building women leaders.
Last year, we celebrated 25 years since the adoption of UN Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace, and security. When we're now facing more pushback than ever, and that pushback is not only well-targeted, but also well-funded. Elise, I know you've been doing some research on this. Could you tell us a bit about what you've found?
Yeah, no problems at all. I actually thought that I might start with the broad picture, because I know our audience is very learned. However, there's always more things to learn about pushback and resistance, and I think it might be a very timely place to start. You may have seen in the news last few weeks some pretty shocking findings from some researchers from Melbourne, Sarah Meagher and Kate Reynolds, who have been doing a big study around misogyny, sexism, resistance, and kind of how it manifests across Australian society. Amongst some of the statistics, the startling statistics that they found is that 17% of those that they studied thought that it was okay to resist feminism with violence. Now, that's pretty stark and shocking. Some of the findings around young men in particular, aged 13 to 17, were very worrying. Around 40% not believing victims or survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. We see from UN Women in 2024 that one in four countries of 195 studied have actually backslid when it's come to gender equality. We know through COVID in particular that there was a lot of gender equality regression in countries. There's been some bouncing back in some contexts, but there's certainly also been a rise in populism and kind of structured sexism and misogyny. I mean, we've talked about the US already. Argentina would be another example. And so across a variety of different metrics, we are seeing some of these challenges. To temper some of that, and actually I'll throw in one more statistic, we also saw in 2024, Diversity Council of Australia saw a doubling of resistance to diversity, equity and inclusion initiatives. But I do want to temper some of this, because when I hear a lot of these things, a lot of these statistics, and we see some of this research come out, it's rightly shocking. And I think it is very, very worrying, and we need to take this very, very seriously. However, there's also a lot that we need to keep in perspective. So the World Economic Forum, over the last two decades that they've been studying the Global Gender Gap report, they've found that 99 out of 100 countries are actually progressing on gender equality when it comes to their metrics of health, economic empowerment, political participation, as well as education. So that's some good news. We also see that in the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, King's College London, big study that they did with Ipsos recently, that across 29 countries globally, 60% of those studied think that things would work better if more women were in charge. So, you know, we've got some more positives maybe there. To follow up on that Diversity Council of Australia research, they repeat this study regularly. It's called the Inclusion at Work Index. And they also found that even though, you know, kind of resistance to diversity, equity and inclusion was up in 2024, they've found that this year it's back down again. So it's down to about 5% now. And support for diversity, equity and inclusion is up. So it used to be 75%, it's now 76%. It's one percentage point difference. But that also reinforces we have 76% of workers out there who are supportive of these initiatives. So I guess I wanted to start with that, because I think that we're seeing a lot in the media. Certainly if anyone's been watching documentaries such as Louis Theroux's Manosphere or other media articles, it can seem like this is really overwhelming. And yes, there is a major problem and we do need to hone in on that. But I think I would take a bit of heart that a majority of Australians care about these sorts of things and they do actually want to continue to see progress. When it comes to women, peace and security specifically, though, and I know, again, most people are probably, or some people maybe are fairly well across what the women, peace and security agenda is. But just in case you're not, United Nations Security Council Resolution 1325 was a landmark resolution that really changed the game 25 years ago. It was the very first time that in this United Nations kind of multilateral, multi-country context that we kind of got together and said, you know what, Women matter to peace and security. They matter, they should be part of the decisions to prevent kind of conflict in the first place, but also once conflict happens, and we're talking about kind of, you know, transitional justice and recovery afterwards, they need to be part of these initiatives. It was partly about getting women to the table in the first place so that they were in the rooms where big decisions were being made. It was also about reducing sexual violence in war and some of the gendered impacts of kind of conflict. And including kind of a really landmark recognition that rape is a tool of war. It is a weapon of war. Now, this, again, was a really significant moment and agreement that for the world to come to. In the 25 years since, I would say that, you know, a lot of progress has been made. I think someone, I'll misquote this, so please just, you know... Be gentle, but I think it's around 100 countries now have national action plans for women, peace and security. So that is basically a country's ability to convert this big international agreement into what they do at home and in practice. There's been a little bit of mixed report cards on how effective that is. I'd say one of the big criticisms in Australia has often been that it treats gendered security concerns as a problem that happens elsewhere in other countries, and we're just here to support, rather than thinking about Australia as a conflict-affected nation and a post-conflict-affected nation. You know, and I heard this a lot in some of the work I did early on with the Women, Peace and Security Coalition. We'd have these really detailed conversations with, you know, regular folk, academics, people in the room who cared about women's roles in conflict resolution and in peace building. And we'd have these conversations about what was happening in Iran or in Afghanistan at the time or wherever in the world. And that was really, really important. And then, you know, if anyone's heard me tell this story again before, sorry. But, you know, and then a young lady pipes up and she says, hey, is anyone able to walk me home to my car now? Because I've got to leave and I don't feel that safe. Now, I think that always sticks with me because we can talk about conflict as something that happens elsewhere and it happens between states. But actually, often it's something that's a real lived reality. And this is kind of this difference between, I don't know, the human side of security versus this really traditional realist idea of what security means. So that's all to say that we've been on a journey when it comes to women, peace and security. And I think that in the research that I've been doing recently with Barbara Trojanowska, who's an affiliate of Global Institute for Women's Leadership and also from Our Watch, we have been looking at applying some really interesting frameworks generated by Michael Flood and colleagues at University of Queensland. And they look at basically being able to categorise what resistance looks like. And they've got this typology of 8 types of resistance out there in the world. And I thought it might be interesting. I promise not to bore you with something deeply academic, but I thought it might be interesting to just run through a few of them, because this is really important actually for being able to identify what is the actual tangible resistance that we're seeing out there in the world and on gender equality, also specifically on women, peace and security. So the first kind of resistance they talk about is denial. And this is this idea that actually gender equality or inequality isn't actually a problem. It doesn't exist. It doesn't matter. It's not a thing that we need to be concerned about. Now, when it comes to the women, peace and security agenda, what we typically see is that this might be an approach such as, oh, well, you know, just doesn't exist here. It's not relevant for us. It's not applicable in our country or in our context. Or just denying that the women, peace and security agenda has a place at all. Why do women matter to security in the first place? So we see denial, that kind of outright blatant denial. Maybe that's relatively easy to recognise. It does happen. It's not always the case, though. Sometimes you see much more subtle forms of resistance. So the second type is disavowal. And this is typically saying, oh, okay, yep, the problem exists. It's just not my problem to fix. So it's disavowing your responsibility to do anything about it. In the case of women, peace and security agenda, this often looks like, well, is that really a UN Security Council issue, or should this be in something that the Commission for the Status of Women or the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, or CEDAW, is this something that's better place for them? Shouldn't UN women be doing this? This doesn't belong in this place where we're discussing hard security concerns. So disavowal is really about, well, it's a problem, but it's just not my problem. Inaction is the third form of resistance. Now, again, we see this quite often. Although a lot of countries have implemented a national action plan, there's still quite a lot of countries that haven't implemented a national action plan. It might also surprise you that the US is one of the only or one of very few countries to not have ratified the CEDAW, so the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Now, this is just phenomenal. They are pretty much the only industrialized country not to have done that. So inaction, that's pretty self-explanatory. The fourth type of resistance that we typically see to gender equality or to women, peace and security in particular is appeasement. So this is kind of pacifying and placating, saying, yeah, that really, really matters. We will definitely do something about that. And then actually not doing much about it. So I think that this is pretty common in policymaking. We tend to see some forms of token actions, but maybe there was never a budget allocated to actually make the thing happen in the first place. So that's certainly been criticism of a lot of women, peace and security national action plans and agendas. You know, yeah, it's great if you sign up and you say, yes, this matters, but if you don't have the resourcing or the implementation plans to go with it, well, it doesn't mean much in substance. We also see, fifthly, appropriation. So this is kind of coupled with co-option, which is the sixth form of resistance, often where we see kind of either undermining implementation or kind of masquerading that I'm going to be doing something about gender equality whilst really not. In international settings, we often see this as kind of using the language of equality whilst undermining equality. So we have seen, and there's been lots of research on this, the use of terms like family values. Now, on the surface, you could say, oh, yeah, I've got a family and I've got values. And yeah, family values, yeah, that matters to me. That's great. Terms like that, though, or phrases like that, are often used to signify very traditional gendered roles and very traditional anti kind of transgender, non-binary, anti women in the workplace, anti, you know, anything that kind of goes against maybe more progressive, equal, sharing notions of who we are as humans. So that's a really good example. And co-option and appropriation, I think, are really important because on the surface, it can look like we're actually doing all the right things and we're saying all the right things and we're funding the right organisations. But covertly, they can actually be doing a huge amount of damage. So the final two types of resistance and backlash that we see typically for gender equality, but women, peace and security in particular, include repression and violence. So repression might be actually dismantling initiatives. So in the US, they have basically walked right away from women, peace and security, despite being the norm entrepreneur globally. So this is kind of the entity or the country that has really pushed for this, and this really matters to the US. Now they've just kind of disbanded it entirely. And violence, of course, we see, you know, real violence in terms of physical, sexual violence against human rights defenders, but also advocates and those standing up for these issues. But we also see epistemic violence. I don't know if you've checked out the Twitter or X accounts of folk like Pete Hegseth, the Secretary for War, or maybe even Trump. I mean, there's a lot of violence in that language and repression and silencing that comes across. So we see resistance everywhere, including in the women, peace and security agenda, as well as gender equality more broadly. And my only kind of mediating points there would be looking at the perspective and what is the trajectory that we as humans are going in. I think hopefully, I'm hopeful still, that we can kind of come together around some of the kind of core principles that matter to us as human beings, care and respect for each other.
I really hope so. I think it is a sad world if we cannot. I want to stay on that thread of multilateralism a little bit longer and talk a little bit about something we saw in the last couple of weeks at the United Nations Commission on the Status of Women. It was the 70th commission, and for anybody who doesn't know, the commission is basically the 2 weeks of the year the United Nations sets aside to talk about gender. It is the principal global forum on gender, and it concludes each session, hopefully, with a set of agreed conclusions, which is a text voted on and agreed, adopted by consensus, that sets the bar for women globally. The 70th Commission happened from the 9th to the 19th of March this year, and for the first time in 70 years, we did not have consensus, and the agreed conclusions were adopted by a vote. And that vote was incredibly historic, and there was only one member state that voted against the agreed conclusions, which was the United States. In this world where we are voting on the most basic rights for women and the most basic tenets of gender equality, is there still hope for multilateralism? I'll throw it to anybody who wants to go first.
Well, look, there's no question the multilateral system has been under strain for a long time, and for many of the reasons that I mentioned. And I mean, it's very sad to hear that about CSW. I can think of so many other forums as well where those things have happened, and it's been a first. And it's by no means just the United States. It's often others. And it's always disappointing. And it's particularly disappointing if it's a country whose values you have thought you had something much in common with. I think multilateralism is getting harder and harder to do in a very divided world. And CSW is a really sad casualty, I think, of that. You know, I spent years of my life working in the multilateral system. I was posted in New York in the very heady days after the Cold War, when it was all possible, when we were negotiating big disarmament treaties. Gareth Evans was our foreign minister. We were all energised. It was a marvellous and exciting time. And a lot of that held for some time, but it's not the case now. And so many of these issues, particularly when it comes to anything to do with human rights, are deeply contested. I was ambassador in Geneva, and some things that we would all in this room just think would be absolutely axiomatic would be the subject of incredibly contested debates and a number of countries refusing to agree to them. So it's always hard, multilateralism, and it's got a lot harder. And this was a casualty, very sadly, of that.
Elise, what about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, I've spent the last few years doing a few big major landmark studies for the United Nations, particularly on outer space affairs, as it happens. And I think this has been a really interesting time to watch what's happening, kind of sitting kind of from that multilateral perspective, looking out and doing some of the research. I think I started in 2024, have carried on since. Let me just say there's been some contestation around research on gender equality and women's participation in a whole range of ways that I never could have imagined would be contentious in the slightest. I think that's really quite disturbing. I think the one thing I hope, though, is that there is maybe too much invested in the architecture that we can just walk away from it, and perhaps that there are such, I guess, established pathways now. You know, they often say I'm an institutionalist scholar, which is probably a little bit boring for most people, but at the end of the day, all it means is that, you know, institutions once established are pretty hard to break or change. And so, you know, maybe, although I'm often arguing that, you know, the institutions we've established, you know, 100 years ago, they weren't great back then, can we please update them? What we know from path dependency is it's really hard to make those changes unless we see some really pretty big critical junctures. So I guess we're just going to see how this space pans out. But I would say we don't have to be passive viewers during this time. I think we don't have to just sit back and let it unfold. I think we all have a role and responsibility, no matter your background, actually. There's always an option for you, whether that's participating in research or supporting organisations like this tonight, or getting out there and working for the system in some way, volunteering and the rest. I think that finding those avenues to support multilateralism and our ability to connect with each other across nations and across very different backgrounds, that's more important than ever. So I really encourage that we kind of invest in that grounded multilateralism as much as possible.
Yeah, look, can I just add to that? I think that's exactly right. And, you know, one of the things I think a lot of countries are doing, including our own, is looking very closely at the multilateral system and thinking what bits of this are really worth preserving, what bits of this should we really put an effort to working with like-minded partners to make work, and what bits, frankly, because there's a lot in the multilateral system that, you know, isn't that much chop, what bits should we just let slide because they're no longer relevant, if they ever were? And then what other pathways can we use to advance the things that we really want to advance? And I think you have to look at it like that, sort of a coalitions of the willing kind of approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And Elise, I think you're absolutely right about updating these institutions that have been around for a very, very long time.
Dr. Elise Stevenson, Deputy Director of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at the ANU, who, as you'll hear,
shortly is also writing a book on sex and outer space. Yes, women's leadership matters beyond Earth too. She's joining former Australian diplomat Caroline Miller in conversation with gender equality activist Asha Clementi. And this is the 2026 Pamela Dinoon Lecture here on ABC Radio National's live event show, Big Ideas, with me, Natasha Mitchell. A conversation this year about why women and their leadership is vital to global security.
One of those institutions that is potentially going to be updated soon is the role of the Secretary General. And Antonio Guterres is nearing the end of his term. And there has been a lot of chatter about whether or not we will finally have our first female Secretary General. But within that, I think that as we talk about multilateralism becoming more unstable, I want to jump to something that actually comes out of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, and that is the glass cliff. And Elise, please correct me if I summarize this wrong. But the glass cliff is essentially a phenomenon where when things are kind of on the brink of collapse, a woman is suddenly elevated to the top and put in this very precarious position, just about ready to be shoved off this cliff. So as we look at multilateralism and the international system, what are your predictions for a first Madam Secretary General? And are you seeing any semblances of a glass cliff in these scenarios? Elise, we'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. Look, I'm not one for predictions, I'm just going to say. However, you know, it's been really interesting to be in circles where a lot of folk are heavily invested in this. I've contributed to some dialogues that happened in Spain in January that were designed for kind of heads of state and UN leaders gathered around. It was at IE University. It was called for the Centre of the Governance of Change, and they were doing this whole series around global women's leadership and voices. And they, I know, are doing a lot of work, a lot of preparatory work, and there's a lot of others who are doing a lot of preparatory work to ensure that whomever is chosen, and hopefully that is a woman, you know, given we've never had one, then this would be, you know, I think an opportunity that should be taken. Having said that, you know, myself and colleagues have written for quite a long time now about how Australia should also have its first ever female ambassador in the UK in Washington, our two, you know, top posts. and which we had the opportunity to update these posts in the last year, so end of last year and earlier this year, and the government still chose not to appoint a woman. So I think that we can't be too hopeful that it's about time. I think that there are, you know, despite goodwill, despite policy imperatives, despite mandates, despite there being opportunity, I think that there's still very much so is this gut reaction of, are we ready? You know, are we ready for a woman in these roles? You know, and I think that that is deeply, deeply worrying and troubling and possibly contributing to the situation we're in an international system. The other point I'd make around that, I think you did a great explanation of the glass cliff. So Michelle Ryan, who's the director of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, coined this phrase, you know, about two decades ago now. The kind of research that we see on this, I think that this is really troubling. And I think a lot of people say, well, that's a great opportunity for that woman who gets up there. You know, she gets to really prove her mettle in a really tough time. But there's things that we should be doing at a kind of organisational, structural and systematic level so that it's not just on women in these positions kind of riding it out and kind of toughing it out against the odds. So I think that we also have an obligation to be thinking about what are the structures and systems and policies and other supports that can ensure that she and anyone else in that role actually has the best chance of being effective in that role, because that is ultimately what we need. We need an effective Secretary General, and I'm not sure where we're landing with that currently.
Caroline?
Yeah, look, it's a very good point, and we've all seen examples of that. It's become an almost unmanageable job, the job of UN Secretary General. I think, you know, the days when Kofi Annan was Secretary General and people talked about the role as a secular pope, they've long since gone. It's such a contested world. The Secretary General has to be able to engage with world leaders, including world leaders where there's not a very healthy or happy rapport, but find some way to talk to them. My view is that preferably you'd want someone who's been a head of government or a head of state, who has that gravitas, who's able to engage. There is a number of people whose names have come forward, including the former president of Chile, Michelle Bachelet, who was previously the High Commissioner for Human Rights. You need someone with that kind of clout to be able to be in that job. You know, Antonio Guterres, I was saying to you two earlier, when he was High Commissioner for Refugees, I worked with him quite closely and I thought he was simply outstanding. The difference between doing a job at that time, it was a much easier time. It was a tough job, but it was a much easier time. I think it's almost impossible now for him to be an effective Secretary General, and that's not a criticism of Antonio Guterres. So I think anyone who takes over that role, including if it's someone like Michelle Bachelet, is going to find it a very impossible task. And will the judgment be harsher because it's a woman? Almost certainly. I don't think, though, that necessarily means that person is not going to be set up to worse for success than most, but I still think it's going to be a harsher judgment because it just always is.
Elise, we're going to jump back to space, or zoom out to space. What patterns are you seeing replicated from international diplomacy and domestic politics in this new frontier? And how are we seeing, or do you see, patriarchy colonize these new spaces?
I always get some strange looks when I talk about studying women in space, but there you go, here we are. This has really come out of my last few years working with the United Nations Office for Outer Space Affairs. Prior to that, I was in the US with the Fulbright Fellowship looking at basically, you know, how does gender and other forms of kind of intersectionality, so ethnicity, sexuality and so on, disability, how do people of these very different backgrounds, how do they experience the space sector and are they represented in it? From some of my research in the early years, you know, I moved on to working with the United Nations, and over the last few years, you know, I've now talked to hundreds of women, from astronauts to astronaut trainers, engineers, rocket scientists, you know, the whole kind of fleet, lawyers, poets, all kinds of space scientists, to just around or just over 100 space agencies plus big organisations, your enterprises, your startups, you know, everyone from NASA to, you know, beyond, UK Space Agency, etc. What's been really interesting about this, a lot of this work, and actually a woman who that I worked with who was a kind of a gender advisor for NASA at the time and worked on one of their advisory groups, she said to me really pithily, you know, space is a place that reflects Earth. And I think that that is both hopeful and deeply worrying. And I'll start with the deeply worrying side. You know, I mentioned before that this is a space that we are seeing a flood of resources, you know, new decisions, new agencies. We've got a space agency as of 2018. This was the very first government agency at a federal level to be founded with a woman at the helm from the start and a gender equal leadership team. We have seen some regressions, however. We've got a Space Command, a very new Space Command in Australia. The US has a Space Command. They have a Space Force. You know, we see all of these interesting things. We see an opportunity maybe to shift the needle or shift the dial by a degree and maybe end up in another trajectory. However, what the data points to, and my research over the number of years and all of these different space agencies and institutions and global leaders, I mean, you know, you see folk like Elon Musk and all, we actually just see a reinforcement of power dynamics. Space isn't a place that's different from Earth. It is embedded in Earth, and it is all about reinforcing power structures on Earth. It's also about privatization. We are seeing increasingly that what happens in space is determined not by nations and their kind of constituents, but by billionaires. You know, I think one researcher calls them tech bro messiahs, the broligarchy. You know, we see all of this language around mostly male billionaires who we see will be the first to maybe colonize space or to mine the moon. If they are the first, they also get dibs on what are the laws, the structures, the rules, the norms for what happens next. Now, that's why this really, really matters. That's why space isn't a far-off concern and something just for dystopian, you know, science fiction novels. What we see, my final P, is the patriarchy. Space patriarchy is very much so alive and well. And I think there's so many interesting dynamics you can explore in that. And, you know, even related to women, peace and security, it was interesting. The bill that created Space Force, this was under Trump in his first term, it was also the same bill that introduced 12 weeks of parental leave for federal government workers for the first time in history in the US. I mean, talk about quite a contradiction. At that time, Trump also introduced a congressional mandate that every department relevant to women, peace and security had to report back to Congress every single year on what they were doing. They had, you know, a kind of unrivaled budget and mandate. Fascinating. Second term, though, that has all been repealed. So I think there's all of these really interesting dynamics here, which mean that space is a place that I would like to see a lot more people take an interest in, because it matters not just for some time and place in the future, but very much so it's embedded in our access to GPS, you know, memory foam technologies and you know, diplomatic decisions and negotiations and everything that happens here on Earth now, today.
What do you see as the future of WPS? How do we keep pushing for progress, and why is it important that the future of WPS is a feminist one? Caroline, we'll go with you first.
Well, you know, I think the future for me is where the issues are so mainstream that we almost don't need it, and we're not there. So we've made progress in that respect, and you see a lot more emphasis, and you've seen that in the last, I would say, 15 years, a lot more emphasis on bringing women into negotiations in conflict. All those sorts of things, having women as part of the conversation. It's not always successful, but you see a big effort to make it happen in a lot of situations. In institutions, I mentioned NATO and the work to try and mainstream it rather than having it as a nice little office off to one side. It does its thing and no one else has to worry about it. As a feminist, I don't even think I quite understand the question. It seems to me it has to be a feminist agenda, but one that is also mainstreamed and becomes everybody's agenda.
Elise?
Yeah, I think for me, for the future of WPS, I'm a little bit worried we get stuck in response mode, which I think is where a lot of the women, peace and security agenda has been for the last quarter century. So if I'm putting my feminist ethics hat on, I think that it has to be much more proactive, and I would love to see that it is much more proactive so that we aren't always in, you know, mopping up the mess kind of territory. And I think alongside that, you know, there's been a lot more work that's gone into an intersectional women, peace and security agenda, and I think that this work is ongoing and needs to continue. And certainly personally, I'm very interested in making sure that LGBTIQ plus rights and considerations are still firmly on the agenda as we move forward.
Now we will throw it out to you guys to questions. Does anybody have questions for our panel?
I think we need a concerted campaign to get the Australian government to sign the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. If we did that, that would affect our alliance with the United States, including the AUKUS and the Force Posture Agreement. Under these agreements, we're complicit with the US nuclear agenda in our own backyard. And I'm wondering, is it too optimistic to imagine an Australia that is independent and peaceful?
Look, I'm an eternal optimist, so I would love to say it's not too optimistic and that maybe it is a possibility. The realist in me would probably say no, but my goodness, I am hopeful. What about you guys?
Well, for the moment, and for both sides of politics in Australia, extended nuclear deterrence is part of Australia's security policy, as is the alliance with the United States. In terms of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, I think the judgment of successive governments has been that without any of the nuclear powers prepared to sign onto it, and they're absolutely not, it's not going to have a lot of impact. And I think that's been the main calculation there.
I mean, I think that I would love to see some shakeups with AUKUS. I don't know that, you know, that what a bungled process to have even got government to that standpoint as it was. So, look, I think independent, I'm not sure. I can't see it yet, but I do think we need to take really seriously your considerations there. It absolutely matters very deeply to our future.
Hi. The phrase that you mentioned earlier, trust over transaction. I'm interested to hear a little bit more about how you can get yourself to a space where you can believe that that's actually a realistic possibility. in this day and age. I'm just thinking, like, over the last sort of 10, maybe even more years, we've seen the divide between, you know, the people who actually have the power and then the people who trust them to use it wisely. How do you believe that that's really even possible when we kind of don't see it anywhere anymore?
The context for that was not my phrase. It was a phrase of President von der Leyen, and she was talking about working with countries that basically share your values and interests. That doesn't mean to say there's no transaction, because we've all, you know, we, for example, during the free trade agreement, there was quite a lot of give and take. But it does mean that you fundamentally are in alignment about where you want to go. And that was what she was talking about. And she was contrasting that with countries that do not, with whom we are not fundamentally in alignment.
Thank you. My limited understanding of the Women, Peace and Security agenda is that it's largely been quite top-down driven by the UN. It's goals set by the UN. So a two-pronged question with, I suppose, a substantial lack of funding now to the UN, how do you see, I guess, the direction of the agenda continuing? And in, I guess, discussions around peace building, how do we also consider transformative justice? So what it looks like to have women included in reconstructing and envisioning societies during and post-conflict, particularly given the amount of intrastate and regional conflict happening at the moment?
Well, I mean, big question. I think, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's a very top-down movement, because that's, I guess, the very definition of a Security Council resolution. I can't make one, that's for sure. So, you know, it has to come from that central, you know, international body and be taken up by states who then pass it down through their infrastructure and, you know, legislate it, or, you know, do kind of make policy around it at that domestic level. So by that one definition, absolutely, it is top down. However, it didn't just come out of nowhere either, right? It's also come out of, you know, decades of feminist movement, or, you know, kind of strategic mobilisation within the United Nations, you know, led by individuals and led by organisations who have buy-in and care, or who are at the front line and you know, persecuted in various ways often. What we see with the Women, Peace and Security agenda in places like Australia often is, you know, kind of this real focus on, you know, making sure that civil society is engaged, and over various national action plans they have and have not been engaged to the degree in which they would like. It's a really tricky space, I think, because, you know, ultimately you are looking at kind of what are these legal or policy instruments that help get more women in the room and that help reduce sexual violence in conflict, and, you know, do all those sorts of things and, you know, have partners there, and there has to be those funding mechanisms.
Look, I think the real worry with global development funds going down is in fact that there won't be necessarily funding for those kinds of programs, and that some of those sorts of things will drop off, and when we really need them, for all the reasons you very articulately put. You know, the huge decline, the huge pulling out of America from large chunks of the multilateral system and the funding for those organisations. I'm thinking of the WHO, for example. It just almost breaks my heart. You really worry about the very likely disproportionate impact on women and girls. And I think this agenda is vulnerable to that. So I really share that concern.
I think we are going to have to wrap up there, unfortunately. But I wanted to say, Elise and Caroline, thank you so, so much for joining me here. And please give one last round of applause for the panel.
A big conversation about women on the world stage, the 2026 Pamela Dunoon Lecture, Feminist Answers in a Dangerous World, held at the ANU in Canberra, featuring Caroline Miller, former Australian Ambassador to the European Union and NATO, Dr. Elise Stevenson, the Deputy Director of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at the Australian National University, and moderated by Asha Clementi, one of the principals of the Persephone Network. Coming up next on the show, join me at the Melbourne Planetarium for a beautiful conversation with dark emu author Bruce Pascoe and astronomer Ray Norris. together talking about their shared love of the dark sky above and Aboriginal astronomy. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Email us, bigideas@abc.net.au is how to get in touch.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.